Hi everybody, you're very welcome to our Irish Studies seminar, and I'm just delighted to welcome you here today, but I'm particularly delighted to welcome Dr. Mary Hatfield. And Mary was a student in our MA in Irish Women's History programme, so she was in the very first MA class that I ever taught. So this is when I start feeling very old now, of course. And as you can imagine, Mary was the absolute ideal student. And in one class, I don't know if you remember, Mary, our class clashed with another event that was happening. So Mary was the only student in the class. And she kept me working for the full 2 hours. I thought I was definitely going to get home early that day. So we last Mary to Trinity College Dublin, where she went to do her PhD, where she... On which this fantastic book that you can see over there in the corner for sale is based. So she then went to Oxford, where she was the Irish government senior scholar at Hertford College. She's now an Irish Research Council postdoctoral fellow at University College Dublin, working with Dr. Catherine Cox at the Centre for the History of Medicine. So besides her fantastic monograph, Mary is very widely published. She has edited a collection on parenthood and childhood. She has another one in the works on happiness in the 19th century. She has published on children's clothing, education for girls, on masculinity, on Dublin boarding schools, and on photographic depictions of Irish childhood. And all of these publications have been leading to, I think, this monograph. So I got this a few months ago, so I've been reading it, absolutely enthralled by it, and I'm sure you'll love it as well. So that's what Mary is speaking to us today. So the book is entitled Growing Up in 19th Century Ireland, A Cultural History of Middle Class Childhood and Gender. And the paper that she's going to deliver is based on chapter 3 of that book.
That's great. Thanks very much, William. That's a very generous introduction, considering I kept you for 2 hours at that class. I don't remember keeping you for 2 hours, but I'm sure I probably did. But thanks very much anyway, and thanks to Queen's for having me today, to Margaret and Peter for having me to the seminar. I'm delighted to be here. So the last time I was in Queen's, I was a master's student, so I feel very privileged now to be up on the podium. So I thought actually I'd begin with a brief discussion of the image that's on the front cover of the book. This is an engraved watercolour by James Malton. It's of St. Stephen's Green in Dublin. It's quite a lively urban scene. We have brightly coloured figures promenading across the park, greeting one another, selling flowers, taking their dogs for an outing. There's all sorts of Dublin inhabitants, adults, men, women, children, dogs, and they're all out taking in the fresh air. I'll draw your attention just to this corner, a little further away from the viewer, dressed in respectable, more subdued clothes, are a father and daughter pair accompanied by the family dog. They're turned away from the viewer, and their faces' anonymity sort of heightens the privacy of their exchange. The father points out deer grazing on the green while clasping his daughter's hand affectionately. Beside them, towards the back of the promenade, two young girls appear selling flowers. Their tattered clothes and baskets tell a different story. No adult accompanies them. They labour independently, perhaps discussing how many flowers they've sold that day as they lean towards each other. Malton's rendering of children in this portrait is interesting because they're not the focal point of the scene. Rather, they appear as part of society but turned away from the viewer, occluded in part by the adults that accompany them. For historians of childhood, that visual metaphor holds a certain poetic accuracy. Our historical understanding of children is typically tied to their relationships with adults, and the experience of childhood itself is dependent on family fortune and misfortune. Children appear in the historical record frequently. They leave many traces of their experiences, but they're typically not the central protagonists. How we understand children's experiences and their expressions are shaped by a communal narrative of childhood that sometimes has very little to do with children themselves. The child throughout history has served as a receptacle of adult ideologies, expectations, and desires. However, children themselves rarely subscribe to these or acquiesce to them passively. Untangling the values and expectations of Irish childhood reflects many of the processes of socialisation that can tell us a great deal about wider cultural priorities. Children are simultaneously forces of change, subjects to socialization, objects of idealization, and individuals, of course, in their own unique historical context. So for today's seminar, I'm going to focus on a theme within the book, which I think draws out some of the complexity of that that difficulty of thinking about children as both subjects and objects. And this is around ideas of fashion and dress, which convey a great deal about middle-class values, the sort of aspirational dimensions of class in Ireland, and the positioning and visibility of the child within the family, but also within wider Irish society. So I'll begin with a letter, which I think quite neatly sums up the anxiety and perhaps all too familiar sense of teenage angst and sort of sensitivity to embarrassment, which is from 13-year-old William Dalton. He was a student in Clongowes Wood College, Kildare, and he sent a rather insistent letter to his father detailing a new suit of clothes that he wished to have for the school's upcoming public exhibition. Quote, "I hope you received a letter from me some time ago containing my measure and all my direction about my clothes. The reason I was so particular was that I believe I will have rather a conspicuous part on the Academy Day and I would be very anxious to be nicely dressed. But be," and he kind of continues on and he goes off on a tangent, but he continues, "but be very particular that they are nicely made. Take care that the waistcoat be long enough and double-breasted, but above all things, be particular about the frock coat, as it's the principal thing. If it has not a velvet collar already, get one put on it and tell the tailor, if he does not do everything rightly, that he will never make a single thing for me again." So William was the son of historian and solicitor John Dalton. He's born in Dublin to a solidly middle-class family, and his attendance at Clongowes places him within a rather elite group of middle-class Catholic children in early 19th century Ireland. Clongowes, an all-boy Jesuit boarding school, offered its students a classical education, but also, and perhaps more importantly, the school imparted an air of gentility, preparing students for their future places in the nation and in the empire. So the Academy Day that William references in his letter is indeed a sort of highlight of the academic year. It's an elaborate pageant of musical performances, prize-giving, and student recitations. His rather demanding letter to his father illustrates the importance he attributed to his appearance on that day and the particular parameters of style which might best portray his status at the school. Such defined views of respectable dress, therefore, are shaped by the sort of wider public discourses on childhood and, of course, gender. So clothing is an important signifier of status and becomes more closely associated with childhood health and well-being during the first four decades of the 19th century. Although the importance of appearance within fashionable society obviously has very long historical antecedents, during this period, children's clothes become scrutinized because of what they say about the discourse of good parenting. Children and infants are more intensely viewed for their appearance, and bourgeois parents are under more cultural pressure to ensure that their children have all the accoutrements of a healthy, happy childhood. Within the deeply hierarchical social world of 19th century Ireland, personal image was consistently conflated with public position. For Irish parents, the public appearance of their children was a source of distinction, pride, and of course, anxiety. Historian Denisoff has argued that during the 19th century, consumer culture relied for its development on small-scale acts of identity formation, acts that were often most readily fulfilled through the young, who were seen as being especially open to and in need of influence, control, and shaping. With an increased emphasis on education and environment, which are other themes that I sort of talk about in the book, the material world of children was becoming increasingly monitored and monetized. The complexity of deciphering the social implications of dress as both a sort of material and discursive construction is complicated by children's traditional representation as passive historical actors. They're simply adorned by their parents in the fashions of the day with very little input, or so it seems. Situating clothing within the context of gestures, postures, and other bodily practices which constituted a wider habitus of Irish middle-class life is useful in shifting our attention from a simple chronology of sort of aesthetic developments in fashion to the function of clothing as it works within a sort of performative quality of class and gender. In the case of William Dalton, he clearly had the power to demand certain kinds of clothes that he thought suited his particular habitus of the boarding school. While infants and younger children perhaps did not have the same sort of literate demands, they could do other things like cry or spoil the garment or perhaps cling to a certain item of favourite clothing as a way of expressing their wants. So as Pierre Bourdieu recognised, Gender relations are established through material and biological constructions, which then elide the social principles that enabled their existence. The circularity of this reasoning is apparent in the politics of children's clothing, where dress is supposed to be indicative of a sort of status or position in society, but at the same time it's meant to socialise the child into their future position in society or their prospective societal role. Within Irish historiography, the history of fashion has focused mainly on national traditions of costume, Irish local industries like lace making, and on representations of Irishness in clothing. There's sort of a separate cognate field here, which is the growing literature on the visual treatment of children in artwork. There's also work on Irish consumer culture, for example, Stephanie Raine's work, which is examining how mass commodification and the innovation of the department store changed the way that people thought about shopping and clothing and created new relationships between clothing and perceptions of status, although Stephanie's work is primarily in the latter half of the 19th century. So here the intention is to explore the rhetorical discourse of children's dress and consider that through the lens of a small selection of material and visual artefacts. The development of a market for children's goods is not unique to Ireland or Britain. Germany, France, Japan and America also see a rise in specialised goods for children across this period, primarily the first half of the 19th century. So by the 1850s, holidays such as Christmas and birthdays were firmly domesticated, with rituals of gift-giving signalling emotional attachment and an interiorisation of family life. That's an argument that's made by Neil Armstrong, the historian, not the astronaut, about the changing ways that fathers interacted with their children. So ritual gift-giving at birthdays was a way for men to partake in family life and celebrate their financial success through acts of fatherly devotion. The whimsy and silliness of fathers celebrating their children's birthday parties highlights a certain sublimation of wealth into childish hijinks. Robert Ball used his connections as a board member of the Dublin Natural History Museum to manufacture a full gorilla suit from bearskin, and he would appear at his children's parties as a surprise guest. His son, Robert Ball Jr., who's born in 1840, so most of these sort of escapades are happening in the 1840s during Robert Ball Jr.'s childhood. He describes the sort of terror that was produced at the size of this man-sized gorilla specimen. Ball Sr. was also a member of the Dublin Zoological Society, where he used his connections to access a full Maori costume from New Zealand for fancy dress balls in Dublin. And in one instance of masquerading, Ball Sr. appeared dressed as a bandit, brandishing a blunderbuss and firing shots up the drawing room chimney, which was happened apparently with resounding rapport. These kinds of playful spectacle were the preserve of the bourgeoisie. They exhibited a kind of doting fatherhood through the entertainment value of the exoticism, which was predicated on cultural and financial capital. So the expanding market for children's goods can be measured at least in part by the expansion of shops, which are exclusively selling toys. Dublin's Pantheon Pushtechnicon was established in the late 18th century as a purveyor of children's toys and goods. Proprietor William Binns advertised the goods and then printed off these pamphlets distributed to parents and children alike. By 1820, there were 8 toy warehouses in Dublin. Belfast had 7 toy shops in 1863, with some familiar families involved in the toy business, including the Searsons and Rankin and Peelin. James Hewitt also boasted a fancy bazaar and toy shop on Donegal Place. Even smaller towns like Dundalk, Kinsale and Strabane each had a resident toy provider. The toy industry was dominated by women at the beginning of the century, as we see depicted in this William Brockes engraving. So I don't know if you can see the detail, but there's toys over in the right-hand side of that painting where the children are kind of looking. She's also smoking a pipe and selling apples. So at the very start of the century, it's more of a sort of female proprietor, single-owned shop. And by the mid-century, it becomes much more male-dominated and kind of more of a warehouse model. So, for example, in Cork, in 1787, there's 4 toy shops. They're operated by 3 men and 1 woman, respectively. As the industry grows during the first 2 decades of the century, there's a fairly open market. And women are 9 out of 13 toy sellers that are recorded in 1824. By 1863, the cork industry has contracted a bit. There's only 7 toy warehouses, and at this date, only 2 women are maintaining premises on their own. So, in effect, the larger companies have sort of replaced the model of this sort of more informal shop. We don't know exactly what merchandise featured in these shops, but if the Varian Brothers advertisement is any indication, then there was quite a wide variety indeed. They had superb rocking horses and good magic lanterns. They're supplied with pop guns and pistols, swords, drums, French tambourines, fifes, small violins, games, puzzles, ninepins, humming tops, farmyards, hunts, parks, puzzles, surprise boxes, and kaleidoscopes. They also had a wide collection of picture books for children, including Andersen's fairy tales and the best of Danish, German, French, and English stories. So how should we dress the children? The codes of dress which are deemed appropriate for children are functioning within a wider discourse about fashion. For the middle classes, the key value shaping taste, at least until the 1840s, was social deference, or dressing in a manner appropriate to one's station. This theme appears in a variety of guises in advice and fictional literature. Advice literature emphasised that clothing for children, while deferring to societal norms, should avoid artifice and ostentation, because these encourage children's vanity and a sense of dishonesty. A French treatise on politeness was translated and published by a lady in Dublin. I say by a lady because she's anonymous, but it was done at the request of Richard Kirwan, president of the Royal Irish Academy. Kirwan had expressed concern that manners were not being given enough attention in public seminaries. The treatise was intended to provide, in a sense, a replacement manners lesson and a sort of explanation of polite behaviour based on moral principles. It's an interesting text in the sense that it's the sort of cosmopolitan nature of fashionable practices and civility is very much drawing on a French model. Francophilia is a feature of the Irish fashionable set during this period, with French clothes, fancy goods and books all being part of the sort of Francified milieu that a lot of these authors and indeed a lot of the more middle and up elite schools are sort of trading in. So in this treatise, when advising on choosing what to wear, the author stated, quote, "Fashion is a law which we must obey in our appearance. Our reason must yield to this despotic sovereign as far as concerns our dress, otherwise we cannot mix in society. Still, however, we must avoid all extremes. By an excess in conforming to it, we appear vain, and by any marked opposition to it, we become ridiculous." So honesty is the sort of moral basis for this construction of suitable fashion. For example, the author recommends that clothing remain proportionate to the body. There's something dishonest about men or women presenting themselves as smaller or larger than they actually are. And this, of course, is in contrast to the 18th century fashion of sort of extravagant bustles, hoops and shoulder pads, which were designed to very much exaggerate the female silhouette. So class, gender and age hierarchies are read visually through the symbolic values attributed to clothing and, of course, the physiognomy of the body wearing the garment. To purposefully manipulate public perceptions by dressing outside of normative styles is sort of discredited as a dishonest performance, particularly if clothing is overly ostentatious, particularly for your class. So if you're a working class girl in Dublin, you shouldn't be dressing as if you're the madame of a house. There's another set, so this is from a book, Treatise on Calisthenic Exercises for the Youth of Young Ladies. Bougeau is brought over from France to work as a gymnastics instructor in the Royal Military Hibernian Academy in Dublin, which had a small section for girls during the first half of the 19th century. So you can see, in terms of the clothing, he's obviously emphasising the movement of the girls because he wants them to be able to do the calisthenic exercises that he's recommending. But we're looking at a much simpler silhouette, which kind of the ruffle at the bottom, square neckline, and like a very simple construction. So the bright colours, the feathers and embroidery that are all characteristics of the 18th century are being exchanged for simpler patterns. Although, of course, this is meant to distinguish the middle classes from the very ostentatious elite and aristocratic classes, but also from the more slovenly, let's say, ragged Catholic peasantry. So turning then to that more sort of, I suppose, the discourse about more deprived fashion, Catherine Alexander, who was patroness of the British and Irish Ladies Society, for improving the condition and promoting the industry and welfare of the female peasantry in Ireland, BILS for short, because that's a very long title. She wrote a pamphlet entitled Friendly Advice to Irish Mothers, which is usually quite well known, although if you're reading through it, you might be stumped as to what was so friendly about her advice. She's quite harsh on some aspects of Irish mothering indeed. She states that regs are disgraceful, whereas patches show industry and discipline. She recommends boys as well as girls should be taught needlework, not just as a utilitarian skill, but as a way of demonstrating cleanliness and hygiene. Keeping a family's clothes clean and well mended indicated not just something about your skills, but about your ability to run a household. Alexander's primary criticism of the Irish peasantry's appearance was a certain unevenness in their use of resources. So she describes them as being slovenly and dirty on most days, with a propensity for dressing in finery that they could not afford on Sundays or special occasions. She noted that the peasantry take pride in their appearance and would skip going to religious services if they didn't have the proper attire. She stated, quote, "Let no one suppose that the excuse so often made of bad clothes or shabby clothes will be any excuse in the sight of God. It is shocking to think how many are kept away from their place of worship by that sort of pride. If their clothing is not of as good a quality as their neighbours, they will stay home from year's end to year's end, quite forgetting that God knows what their circumstances are. And if it is not by misspending their earnings or by careless living they are poor, he will not blame them for what is his will." So Alexander's remarks reflect a certain suspicion of poverty as a product of willful negligence rather than actual circumstance. She also stated, "The excuse of bad clothes is never set forth if they choose to go to markets or fairs or wakes or to any place where they wish to go." Other authors commented disparagingly about this practice of the peasantry dressing in rags during the whole week, only to appear in ridiculous finery, in their eyes ridiculous, for Sunday services. In the cottage fireside in 1821, there's sort of a fictional conversation between a grandmother and her granddaughter, young Jenny, about selecting material, and she's sort of dissuaded from buying the cheaper material that looks nicer and instead going for a good hearty calico that will last for several years instead of a more sort of fancy material. The author of this tract stated their disapproval of people who would look like pigs during the week, that's a quote, but dressed extremely well on Sundays. This opposition to sort of a showy exhibitionism is a hallmark of the sort of bourgeois sensibility. There's an emphasis on the sturdy, the dependable, durable aspects of clothing, and there's an encouragement of the lower classes to consider practicality above aesthetics. It's contributing, in a sense, to an idea of poverty as a matter of poor economizing and decision-making by adults, and that figure of the child in rags becomes a potent symbol of how individual decisions could affect a whole family. So the moral failings associated with the wrong kind of clothing were generally characterized in different ways for boys and girls. For girls, frivolous dress suggested a superficiality, a lack of intellectual and moral rigor, and a degree of selfishness. So Edward Ryan, who was vicar of St. Luke's Church of Ireland Parish in Dublin, was very critical of the vacuous amusements of leisured girlhood, which he thought inevitably produced vain women. He's writing his text basically in the style of Hannah Moore, but arguing that his mission is to do for the upper classes what Hannah Moore did to reform the poor. So he's warning sort of upper class teenagers, effectively, about the sort of the trials and tribulations of having too much wealth and too much time on your hands. So he warns his male readers that any woman who's absorbed by dressing would be unsuitable as a wife. Quote, "If she is adverse to work suited to her condition, if novels are her study and coxcombs her favourites, if her chief delight is in dress, dancing, admiration and external accomplishments, you may suppose her mind is shabbily furnished and that she will be a dull and insipid wife at home, abroad a gossiper, or perhaps worse, should be fond of scandal and public amusements." The suspicion of female adornment and a preoccupation with outward appearance is also used to criticise female education, which was supposedly lacked a real intellectual content and was merely focused on the appearance of accomplishment. Rothwell's portrait of the very picture of idleness illustrates the type of female associated with this kind of vanity and ostentatiousness. She's leaning towards the viewer, she's smiling coquettishly, and she's adorned with necklaces, ribbons, and silks. Her bare shoulders and loose hair suggest a sense of impropriety, indicating the likely future of an idle girl, who, though charming, was lazy, superficial, and possibly in search of entertainment, likely the unsavory type. So the intersection of age and gender are also concisely illustrated in a caricature, this one drawn by Henry Brockes, a Dublin engraver, and it shows a young girl exhibiting her latest finery replete with lace and a flowered bonnet, while her mother scowls and labours over a wash bucket. And I'll zoom in here just so you can see the scowl on the mother's face. It's quite impressive. So the mother, it's hard to make out, but there's a bit of writing at the bottom there. The mother condemns the girl for leaving her to feed the pigs and break her health, while the younger sister, who's just in the far right corner there, the younger sister says, "Oh, Mama, don't scold Marianne." So vanity as a moral fault is not the monopoly of young girls. Physicians Henry Moncel and Richard Evanson were critical of parental vanity that caused parents to parade their children in clothes that were very unsuitable to the cold weather. Quote, "The cap and feathers set upon, but not covering the child's head, and probably of a colour and richness which contrasts mournfully with the blue ears, sharpened nose, and shrunken cheeks in which cold has assumed the features of starvation, this is the lot of the Irish child." So this disapproval of extravagant children's costumes was intended to demonstrate a certain rationality, and that's being drawn very much from a sort of medical idea of what would suit childhood health. Parents, of course, did take pride in how their children looked. For example, Lady Eliza Dean of Blackrock, Cork, she was the wife of architect Thomas Dean, recorded in her diary for 1832 how delighted she was with the healthy appearance of her son Thomas on his fourth birthday. Quote, "He was dressed in a new nankeen frock made by Jane, and he looked quite handsome. His old nurse Ellen was in delight with him. He danced and was as gay as a little cricket." The occasion was made even more poignant for Lady Eliza because she had lost her infant son Robert just 6 months previously. He was born and died 2 to 3 days after birth. The delicacy of taste and fashion that's expressed by the middle classes suggests a quite narrow band of approval, and that's particularly in women's fashions. The fashions of the day are often publicised in newspaper. After a big social event in Dublin, there'd be sort of a long column describing what every attendee had worn. For example, when the Wiley sisters were presented to society in 1861, they wore identical ensembles of white dresses typical for presentation, but they were trimmed with bullions of tulle, white roses and lily of the valley, jupe of white tarlatane, flounces and tunic looped with white roses, lappets and court plume ornaments and diamonds. Another entry in Saunders' newsletter for a St. Patrick's Day party in 1829, reported that one Miss Montgomery wore a white tulle dress ornamented with bullions of tulle and bows of satin, the bust tastefully arranged with French blonde lace, rouleaus of satin, train of French white satin ornamented with tulle, a headdress of feathers and pearls, and this dress was universally admired for its elegant simplicity and suited to the lovely wear. Now, after that description, I don't know if simplicity would be the first word that we would use to describe that sort of dress, but that's neither here nor there. Eleanor O'Callaghan, the daughter of a Limerick merchant, completed her education at the Presentation Convent in Cork and returned at the age of 17 to join in Limerick's social scene. And she sort of records in her diary all the outings that she has, and of course what people are wearing is sort of a relatively frequent observation that she makes. She described in her diary the appearance of one Rebecca Bennett at a party for Shrove Tuesday in 1839 as, "She had a most singular headstrip consisting of bunches of curled white ribbons at each side, and behind her frock was black Turk silk. Her appearance excited all our risible faculties, and really, some of the ladies were on the verge of suffocation." Another Maria Hackett, also a former boarding school miss from Cork, recorded in her diary in 1861 the sartorial choices of her companions. Quote, "There were some very handsome dresses at Maher's, such as pink and blue. The two little Lochrans were at it and are very much liked, though they're not very pretty. Fanny Dillon's dress was not very handsome, although it had a silk slip under it." So clothing is kind of central to the way that age gradations during infancy and childhood are represented. Infants, when they're first born, were put into very long gowns that extended past their feet as a way of providing extra warmth. And when infants started crawling around or being a bit more mobile, usually around 7 or 8 months, they're given a shorter gown and petticoats. So from the first 4 to 7 years of a boy's and girl's lives, they were dressed pretty much the same, with petticoats and a short bodice and pantaloons. So here's young boys in 1892 dressed in a sort of traditional petticoat and waist jacket. So freedom of movement is quite an important feature, particularly for physicians describing what parents should put their children into. They discourage stays and corsets, which do remain they're discouraged, but people are still buying them up until the very late 19th century. So while girls' clothing is transitioning into women's clothing through subtle details like the lengthening of a hemline or a different hairstyle, young boys' breeching is the sort of definitive break from the feminized sphere of childhood. Within the domestication of family life, children become more closely associated with the sort of maternally dominated domestic space. And it's when boys leave the space of the home and the nursery, usually to go to school, they're given the masculine garment, which is the breeching. Parents marked out breeching as a very sort of momentous life occasion. In 1866, John Paul Lawless Pine, who was rector of Church of Ireland in Cloyne, recorded in his diary how his wife's friend had stopped in with a pattern of clothes for his son, who was about to have his first pair of trousers. Trousers were also sort of another layer of difficulty for very young boys who were learning to use the toilet. Thomas Drennan, the son of William Drennan, was given his first pair of trousers at the age of 3, and his aunt stated that he had, quote, forethought enough to go to a manservant and say, "But how in all the world, James, do you do with your breeches when you go to puff?" Puff was Thomas's word for using the toilet. About a week later, Martha McTeer reports in a letter to Thomas's father that he has got on his trousers, which are quite easy to him, and he is every inch a gentleman's child. So I'll just make a comment here in conclusion. So children's clothing was determined from a complex negotiation of what was available for purchase, what parents could afford, and what children would agree to. It seems reasonable to argue that parents dressed their children with care and affection, seeking to provide clothes which indicated the child's present and future status within society. Dress and fashion were connected to other habits of polite manners and characterized as an element of childhood education. The persistent misrecognition of material interest involved in the expenditure on children's clothes, toys, and gifts as emotional exchanges was necessary for a sort of separation of economy from personal life, and is certainly a hallmark of class distinction. And that's sort of a broader argument to be made about the transformation of work and family life during this period. Letters like the one from William Dalton, which opened this paper, are a reminder that children did have a role in determining their own clothes, and they were aware of the social importance attributed to their appearance. By the mid-19th century, the proper costume for children, appropriate for their age and gender, was becoming an integral element of middle-class identity and respectability. Thanks very much.